So you probably, even in your short time you've been back in yeshiva, the time you've been there, you can probably sense that there are some adults who aren't really part of the yeshiva staff who are always here in yeshiva. And they're always interacting with yeshiva, whether they're local Israelis or people from Chutz Laaretz who are here 2-3 times a year, always coming back. And by extension, that's just part of yeshiva life, part of Israel life. So it's really, it shouldn't just be seen as a 1 or 2 off experience just to recharge your batteries, but part of your chinuch and part of your orientation is these types of experiences, even at a distance, and in the world of social media, as we'll talk about, it's a great connector and it's a great bridge, but even without social media, try to keep that identity. Also, big yeshiva kach to Taig for putting this all together and for being a nudnik and for coming over 3-4 times and reminding me, because that's what it took to remind me. This is a particularly zany part of my year right now, so maybe your summer, but we're just getting geared up for the stampede of Americans that want to come next year. We're trying to keep them down, but sometimes not too much avail, but it's a very crazy period of time, so it's good that we have a chance to get together. Obviously, the premise of today's talk is that we don't view technology or modernity as alien or dangerous. It's just a tool. But as with every tool, especially tools that are new to human experience, they carry challenges and unknowns, and sometimes the danger of early adopters is that they end up being guinea pigs. Basically, in a large scale, that's really the difference between charedim and non-charedim. Non-charedim are early adopters, and they embrace modernity and try to channel one of the benefits of that early adoption. And they also serve as guinea pigs to discover some of the dangers and challenges and pitfalls. And charedim, by and large, have to buy into it eventually. You can't stop technology. Technology is inevitable. I told you the great debate in Germany in the 30s between the Haredi community and the non-Haredi community was about the following technology or media and whether it was appropriate for the conveyance of Torah ideas. There was a big debate about newspapers. And the Haredi world believed that newspapers were treif media, and no matter what you put in those newspapers, even if it was Torah, the concept of a newspaper, because it was associated with gossip and with slander and pornography, a newspaper was unholy. You can walk into any Haredi home today and find a newspaper. And the same debate to a degree happened with telephones. It just happened too quickly. Telephone just happened so quickly, and the penetration into homes and the market penetration was so quick that it didn't really read about the debate. To a degree, in my generation, the same was true about college, where there were great debates about college and collegiate education. From the Haredi standpoint, stepping foot in a college was tantamount to fear. And today, everyone knows you have to get a degree one way or another. The question is how: day school, night school, summer school, Vanish Moshe school. Everyone's involved in some form of education, but and it's the same is going to happen more or less with technology. And again, sometimes it's not great to be an early adopter. Sometimes it's good to take things slow. That's not true just about technology. If you ask me what will happen in 20 or 30 years or 40 years, will we carve out space for women in Torah education that resembles smicha, that's called smicha? It may happen, but it's a slow process. And to understand where it happens and how it happens and what are the dangers and what are the appropriate measures and what are the ripple effects. So that's why I'm staunchly opposed to granting women smicha. Will it happen in my lifetime? Maybe. But it's just not something right now that I think is just to jump in and ruin so many parts of our masorah that could be upended by the shifting of traditional roles and by the questioning of smicha. Because again, it's not. It's usher to give a woman an aliyah. There's no way around that. If you want to give a woman an aliyah, so you have to really do calisthenics in halacha, or just ditch halacha. If you ditch halacha, then you're not the orthodox. If you do calisthenics, at least you're orthodox, but you're doing things with, you know, you're making a diuk in a ritva, which is incorrect. But it's in first gilar, the woman shouldn't have an aliyah. When it comes to smicha, it's very, very flimsy. It's because the whole smicha is just more or less a consensus. We don't really have full smicha. Smicha was originally Ishmi P, Ishma Trevino gave smicha to Yoshua, gave to this gate, and we gave. I don't have smicha. We lost smicha around the time of the second base of Mikdash destruction. So today we just have it. You learn in yeshiva and you get acknowledged, you have a lot of Torah, and you're allowed to paskin. It's just, it's not the same smicha we used to have, unfortunately. And hence the whole question of whether women have a smicha. But it's a very, very important question because it strikes at the heart of how we operate as an Orthodox community. So I think the same thing is true of technology. And since we are early adopters, it's really important to question how you use it and what are the impacts of using it. And to be honest with yourself, not to be all in. There's a certain cool factor or sexiness associated with technology. Almost if you have to be embarrassed if you're a Luddite or you're not technology oriented, if you're the person in the room that doesn't have the latest smartphone or the latest smartwatch, or that was embarrassing. And that in itself is a dangerous attitude because it leads to avarice and to greed and just wanting things for greedy purposes and just to have things and maybe even ostentation and show off your riches. So to be careful not to join the herd. Oh, Samsung just released its latest non-explodable note, so let me run out and get it or something, because everyone's getting it. And you certainly sense that craze with people waiting online for their phones all night and can't bound. Okay, so I don't think we're that extreme or that radical, but there is a certain amount with keeping up with the Joneses and have to get the latest one, and ask yourself honestly if you really need the computing power or the capacity that new technological device will provide, then of course, and use it for the right way. Maybe ask yourself, instead of upgrading, just upgrade, maybe think how much it will cost to upgrade, and then give that money to stop. And maybe it'll be a bigger mess, assuming you have the same. And there's always going to be a little more computing force, and if you really feel you can use it, then that becomes a need, like any other need, like putting clothing on, or especially if they need to use constructively. So certainly, before I discuss anything in particular, it's just important to understand there's a culture associated with technology that can hypnotize you or stupefy you. It's important not to get caught up in that culture. Even before you mention the word Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or mobile computing or cell phone or internet, just there's a culture out there that has to be very, very carefully filtered. I think when it comes to discussing these issues, people do a disservice to themselves by clumping together three areas. And they clearly overlap, but you don't get maximum resolution, to use a technological term, if you clump them together rather than separating them. There really are three issues that you should consider about your interface with technologies in Avodat Hashem. And there's a tremendous amount of overlap, but they really are three different areas to wrestle with. Number one is internet. We live in the world of internet. We've got access to a whole world. What are the challenges? What are the opportunities? What are the potentials? How do you balance it? Number two is mobile computing. And you can even draw a timeline. Let's say the internet becomes very popular and utilitarian around the year 2000, more or less, and it becomes very useful before it exists, but it's very crude. Let's say mobile computing comes of age in 2005, 2008, more or less with the iPhone, where people feel comfortable using and of course, you can sense the graph where mobile surfing overtakes desktop surfing, so you can always see it in the market graphs. So that's the second issue. It's not just internet, but the ubiquity of internet and constant access. And what does it mean to constantly have the phone available? And what does it mean to constantly be distracted? Internet doesn't create that sense of distraction. It's in a mobile computer, and it's what we call cell phones or smartphones. And the third issue, you could just jump 5 years later, social media. 5 years later, 6 years later. So those are three very, very different realms. You could have internet and not have a smartphone. You could have a smartphone and not use social media. And sometimes we just get lost in this very nebulous and vague conversation, and we don't hit the mark. We're talking about one thing, and really we think we're talking about another, and our messages or our discussions to ourselves and others are very undefined. It's really important to bear in and say, what are we talking about? The internet use. So the internet use is 15 years old already. And obviously, much of what has to be said has been said already. I think most of the dangers, I would probably classify the dangers into two different sets in each area. In each of these three categories, I would say, imagine a Rabbi Stephen K. table. Before there were Rabbi K. tables or Rabbi Tarek tables. Imagine a table where each one splits into two. So in each area, you have to consider the developmental challenges and the religious challenges. Namely, what factors would I deliver, would I raise if I were giving a TED talk in Harvard? If I were giving a TED talk, what would I be warning consumers about internet, warning users about mobile computing, and warning users about social media? What would my message be to be a healthy and upstanding human being, which of course is part of being an Avodat Hashem, is being a healthy human being. And then there are unique challenges to being an Avodat Hashem, which quite frankly you don't have to face if you're not Jewish or you're not religiously oriented. So in each area you have to ask yourself what type of challenge, and again, sometimes our minds migrate immediately to religious areas and not to developmental areas, and sometimes the developmental challenges are even more concerning. They're religious. Obviously, when it comes to internet, and exponentially more so when it comes to mobile internet or phone use, you've got the twin religious issues of time usage and exposure to information, graphics, and ideas that you'd rather not be exposed to. And that itself subdivides into voluntary access or involuntary access. It's a combination of the two. Sometimes we intentionally access things and even intentionally. Sometimes we're out to look for that. Sometimes it's just curiosity. We're just surfing around, and oh, one thing leads to another. You're not even aware of where you're heading. Sometimes it's just involuntary. You just do a search, and the wrong type of image comes up, or the wrong. Sometimes you look at a YouTube video, and all of a sudden the suggested videos on the side are not necessarily images or ideas you'd like to be exposed to. So these are very serious issues. The good news is, well, it's not the good news, but it should. A lot of them are sexually driven because we live in an age in which your sexual desires and awareness is prematurely incited and over-incited, and your expression of that healthy sexuality is delayed because of adolescence. Remember, 200 years ago, adolescence didn't exist. Everyone got married when they were 13 or 14. So more or less there's a coincidence between sexual awareness and sexual expression. Today we've got this gap, and it's very frustrating, and to a degree, I'm happy it's frustrating because healthy heterosexuality is something that we're happy when it exists, and it's a bracha from Hashem, and unfortunately in today's very confused world, it's not a given. So healthy heterosexuality, the fact that you feel stifled sexually and you feel attracted to the other sex is something, quite frankly, we're happy. I mean, I told the Machanech the other time I was in America, when I used to see the pictures that boys posted on their Facebook with their girlfriends draped around them or sitting on their laps or whatever, I got really irate. There's a part of me that today's very happy when I see those pictures, because at least, sadly, it's a very confusing world, and no one's blaming anyone. A lot of people, homosexuals, feel that they're born that way. It's hard to judge anyone or know anything about experiences we haven't been involved in, but certainly it's a confusing world. Certainly, you know, Hashem's will is that we should all be heterosexual. I wonder why he may have created people with different inclinations, and it's hard to know. There are a lot of mysteries, but it's certainly clear, so we certainly, you know, we favor heterosexual, heterosexual world. Doesn't mean we discriminate against homosexuals, but I mean, if we could wave a magic wand, everyone would be attracted to the other sex. It certainly wasn't the reality. It's not even assessment. But once you get married, a lot of this pressure should subside once you're able to express your sexuality and your healthy heterosexual expression in the right context of a marriage. A lot of it should dissipate, but it doesn't always. You have to be aware of it. Don't just assume it's because you're getting married. Many cases of people that are addicted to pornography and online activity even after marriage. And it's not just about satiating sexual desires, but understanding what sexuality is about and what it's meant to serve, and not objectifying, not drawing pleasure. I mean, it's just really like you understand all of your emotions and all of your personal aspects. You want to understand what sexuality is about and what you should express it and when you should express it, or more appropriately, how you should express it. So don't assume that the nature of these things, you find that the nature of addiction, you're shocked. I mean, so much, why do you need more? Why do you need more? That's the nature of addiction, is it feeds itself, is an ever-growing torrent, an ever-growing pressure. Time-wasting also. I can't say that the internet is the primary culprit for time-wasting. I would say the culture really preaches time-wasting. It's the internet that's the accomplice, or the wingman. I mean, sports and 24-hour entertainment, and the internet is just a method of delivery, but it really means a mind shift where you're on this planet to work. It's not even the internet and movies. It's just a question of when you're young, sometimes you feel like, I just want to work and work and work to become successful. And that's not a mature or certainly a religiously mature attitude. We're put on this world to work and to produce and to work as much as we can and serve this world and improve this world. However broadly you define it, every fiber of being, we're not meant to relax. We're not meant to. Which Baruch Hu gave us restorative and replenishing capacities. And I could see this in my 13-year-old. When I talk to my 13-year-old and he complains to me about how much work he has, I'm trying to ease him slowly into that reality that that's what it's supposed to be. Your day is supposed to be full of work and productivity. Obviously, people have stress levels and they need ways to release stress and to relax. And that's certainly very, very incongruent with the culture we live in, which provides and preaches. If you're interested, it's probably just the residue of the identity collapse of World War I. World War I was a collapse of identity. Everything people thought existed was proven to be untrue. And pretty much, it's still 100 years later, and man hasn't found the answers to that search for identity. So instead of looking for answers and identity, he basically wants to just drug himself with opiates of entertainment and not have to think about reality. I'm being entertained all the time, I don't have to think. So drug is a very, very radical, extreme dullard of senses. You just lose your senses and you just relax. Entertainment's a soft drug. Essentially, you're just immersed in this fantasy world of drama, sexuality, action, thriller, horror, or fantasy, whatever those unreal worlds that take you out of your reality, and you don't have to face reality. remember dealing with a boy quite some time ago. He came from a very, very difficult home environment. These were the days when a major challenge in yeshiva were DVDs, because people were watching series, entire television series on DVDs. And literally, guys came with an entire season of and fill in the blanks of their favorite shows, and they were exchanging the DVDs. And remember, this was it caught like fire in a prairie. It was unstoppable. And I remember having a conversation with him, and he was a very depressed young man, and he came from a broken home, and he basically looked at me and he said, "I just had a very, very difficult life." And because I asked him, "You realize all these crime thrillers are built out of the same fabric. I could write them in my sleep, and the plots are the same, and you can tell who did it. It's all the same mumble-jumble evidence and forensics and spies, and it's all the same script, just mumbled and jumbled." Like, what? So they understand, but I like these action or fantasy or crime because I like playing out these roles because my life is so frustrating to me. I just like stepping into it. I was actually very impressed when you could articulate. I just put myself into a different place. We'd like to think that we don't want to put ourselves into a different place. We'd like to look at sleep as something which we try to avoid as little, as much as possible. Is that what we need for help? We want to live every minute. If, let's say, someone came to you and said, "I have a choice. You could die now or die in 50 years. We want to live because we want to produce. And the time that we're not living, that we're sleeping or that we're otherwise distracted. So it may tiltillate our hearts and it may excite us and get our blood pumping, but that's not core of what we're meant to be. What does that mean? Try to think of the difference between excitement and pleasure and meaning. So when you go to a bra, you get excited, you enjoy it. 5 hours later, there's nothing left except for a full stomach and possibly frequent trips to the little boys room. There's nothing. You see a movie, you see a chase, and you get excited. 5 hours later, when's the last time you did something you like that created meaning? 5 hours later, 5 days later, "Oh, I'm a changed person because I performed chesed, read a book, thought of an idea, discovered a household, helped a friend, became a better person, repaired a mida, whatever." That's full meaning. That's lasting. That's enduring. So I don't think the internet is the culprit. The internet is just a great facilitator. But we're headed on an arc long before the internet happened, with movie and television, entertainment, and the entire culture of entertainment. And the internet was pouring kerosene on the fire. The fire started well before the internet. It's just important to understand that, to grasp that, and to have a mental shift, not looking to be entertained. And everyone, I also sometimes at night when I'm relaxing after a long day, I'll just surf, look at a few news sites and maybe a sports site or something just to see what's going on. But to learn to cap it and learn to, okay, so I'll do it for 20 minutes, and however some people want to do it artificially by having some internet meter on their surfing, a warning, you've now been on for 20 minutes. For some people, it's self-correcting. But very often in life, consciousness is half of the solution, or 90 minutes. If you're conscious of what the challenge is, and you're conscious, then you know how to solve it. If you just let yourself flow with dynamics larger than yourself, then you just can get drawn along involuntarily. If you're just aware of it, okay, this is an entertainment culture. I'm going to dip into it, but I'm not going to be immersed in it. I'm not going to be hypnotized or captured by it. It's much easier. So I think those are the two issues that I would think about regarding internet. With phone use, I think phone use, I would say probably the greater concern is distraction. I don't see anything. Obviously, when it comes to religion and Avodas Hashem, I think that the phone is the great enemy of davening. And I would strongly encourage you, first of all, by all means necessary, davening should be a no cell phone zone, no ifs, ands, or buts. And the only time you should ever have your cell phone on in davening is if you're in a location which you don't have a sitter or a plane or something, you can't use a sitter. But anytime you have a sitter, you should use it, unless sometimes my eyes hurt me. So again, I won't do it in yeshiva because I'm on duty and I can't take the wrong model, but sometimes I'll just use my phone because my eyes are weaker. But assuming there aren't any practical ramifications, you should always just avoid. And certainly, even if you have to use the sitter, you should put the phone aside on airplane mode and clear all your notifications and just use it as a slave for text, not for anything else, which I think most people are aware of, or certainly the schools are aware of. Obviously, once you leave school, you're on your own, but the notion, the premonition, you want to have a extended interaction with the Kodesh Baruch Hu at some level, some intimate interaction, some focus, and some connection, and you're going to flood your mind, especially in a world in which our mind is flooded already. Already kavanah and already tefillah awareness is so challenged. To introduce new factors and new information, new ideas into that, it's just very, very debilitating for what tefillah is meant to accomplish. And I would say the same thing in terms of, and this is probably a little more subtle, but not just as valuable, but extremely valuable. Try your hardest, if you can, not to open your phone until after davening. Because if you're looking at your phone before davening, you'll inevitably read a few emails, a few messages, and you don't always have that choice. Let's face it, you'll be a doctor one day, and you have to know patients may need your attention immediately. I'm a father, so I have to be in touch with my wife during the early stages of the day, just for logistics, or sometimes I need to know who's coming to yeshiva that day, so you don't always have that choice. It's not a ironclad rule, but if you can, try to avoid, in general, changing tefillah patterns. This is a whole different conversation. Tefillah is very different for us than it was for our ancestors. But one casualty has been a very lackadaisical attitude to the pre-tefillah experience. Let me tell you what I mean. I was in Philadelphia this weekend, and they had a schedule. And part of my schedule was before davening at 8:15, I was going to speak about Rav Lichtenstein or Rav Amital to the community. Davening was at 9, so it was a 45-minute session. Okay. And the plan was I would choose one or two characteristic different Torah of each Rosh Hashiva on Parshas Vayigash and use that as a springboard to discuss who they were and what their mission was. A little bit like the Rosh Hashiva Chag we started here in Yeshiva. Okay, so I was planning, looking for various topics that Rav Aaron had spoken about on Vayigash to extrapolate from. And then I saw the poster that was being used to publicize the weekend, and the poster had all the timings and the schedule, and it had 8:15, and the title or the unit was slated as Coffee with Rabbi Tarragon and 9 o'clock davening. Now, Rav Lichtenstein would frequently spend almost a third of his speech critiquing the title, because titles are always premised on certain assumptions that may not be true. You want to say, you can't just launch into an idea of a question. What are the assumptions? So whenever they have to speak about Torah Manda, Torah and the synthesis, they can, anything that's synthesized with Torah, Torah is a standalone. But always make sure that you set that blockade against just facile and naive assumption thing. So I said, the best thing I could do now, in the spirit of Ravara, is question the title. Ravara Brachos and Daf Yud. They're all sitting there with their coffee. Ravara Brachos Daf Yud says, L'soch l'aladam, there's an Isser D'oraisa to eat before davening. And the Gemara continues based on a pasuk in Mishlei, Ve'osi Hishlachlu Achrei Goyecha, that it's like you're throwing Hashem behind you. I'll get to you, Hashem. It's like a sign of arrogance, not just a formal iser, but it's like you're being arrogant and cocky. I'll get to you, Hashem. I'll say I have my drink. Now, there are various hater. And certainly, if you're people that get up early today to learn, and they need their coffee to learn better, so it's mutter. If your coffee will help you daven, it's mutter. Be honest with yourself. So the good thing about it was that I came clean during that speech. I had already eaten that morning, so I wasn't castigating anyone, but I was being honest because when I travel, I drug myself very heavily for sleeping purposes, and to counteract the drugs, I have to take something in the morning or else my head's still swirling. So I had already drunk, but I won't touch anything before davening. So each person has to have their own honesty and integrity, but to put on the schedule, coffee, at 8:15, and davening at 9 was very troubling to me. Even when I'm on Pesach programs, I ask the person who writes the Pesach program, their coffee and tea is available if you need it or something in the lobby before davening. But like a schedule, we all show up with our cups of coffee while we're waiting to meet up with Baruch Hu. It's not just the coffee, it's also. So your parents lived in a different time. They could roll out of bed and run right to shul and get to the shender and start davening at Kodesh Baruch Hu. Those of you who serve in the army, and you realize that's elusive, and even today with transportation, you have to beat traffic, you have to take the kids to school, and you have to, and there's a lot of different, so don't introduce something else. Try to keep your mind as clean as possible, so when you come to davening, all you have is, imagine how powerful it is to go to sleep with Kabbalah's Malchus Shalayim to wake up with Kabbalah's Malchus Shalayim, nothing in between. It's a beautiful, I think it's a Mani, the Sefer Amani, Ruben Hayakri, 13th century French Rishon. Famous question, why is Olakai Nishalash and Nesata Bitahari? Rochat Hashem, Machzin Shalal Sifgarim Meisim. You revived me. Beautiful bracha. You died last night, Hashem revived you. Not so pashim, you get up in the morning. Why doesn't that begin with the word Baruch? every bracha should begin with a baruch. So the most common answer is a bracha smucha l'chavrta. It's a bracha which is adjacent to a prior bracha. What's the bracha that it's adjacent to? Berachas HaTorah. So people have a minhag to say Berachas HaTorah, then L'kayin Hashem, and then to circle back and say Elul Devarim and Yivarchacha, just to juxtapose L'kayin Hashem with Berachas HaTorah. But there's a manhag, I think, why not we drum, who says, it's a bracha smucha l'chavrta, it's adjacent to which bracha? Hamatel. You say Hamatel, you go to sleep, and you wake up and say L'kayin Hashem. And then what about the 6 hours or so that transpired in between? Okay, it's a structural bracha smucha. Structurally, one bracha is when you put your neshama in Hashem's hand, and one bracha is when you take your neshama back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So even if 6 hours have transpired, it's the same thing. You're still making the same bracha. It's a beautiful concept. And a person who has that consciousness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the real recognition of vulnerability doesn't just get up with an assumed reality, but puts himself in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hands at night, and then really is thankful for the revival of those opportunities in the morning, which is, you know, it's not always so simple or assumed. So, in terms of cell phone, I would say to be very, very, very careful with davening. You have to really understand that your cell phone is your enemy for tefillah, and really avoid chalila v'chasa using the cell phone. Again, you shouldn't cast aspersions on people's use, because everyone, in a perfect world, I know that I can control myself, and I'm not going to look at anything on my cell phone during davening. And once in a while, I have to give a shiur right after davening. I want to look up something on Google that has to do with the shiur. So I'm basically looking up the sefer. I don't do it in yeshiva because people won't understand it. And they won't understand that I'm Googling a wiki about the Yochanan bin Prachi or something. But in your own home, if you're obviously in little Chazaras HaShatz or whatever, but just understand that it's a very, very, very dangerous dissipator or evaporator of davening. In terms of developmental challenges, I think it's the distraction, the lack of focus, the shallowness. I would say on two fronts. Number one, just the actual impact upon the ability to focus and think deeply and think carefully. And I think it creates a little bit of shallowness. On the other end, it also eats away self-discipline. It's completely into other areas of the lack of self-discipline. And once you lose your self-discipline in one area, self-discipline is very contagious. Some of those boys are having a hard time coming to Minyan or I say, you know, go work out in the gym. If I had to work out in the gym, it's like some people who are socially derelict, people that fall out of society, drug addicts and dysfunctional and juvenile delinquents, so I'll send them to boot camp. I'll send them to boot camp to rehabilitate them. Boot camp, they'll learn discipline. What do you mean? So they'll survive in boot camp. How are they going to survive in the real world? But the presumption is that part of it is by endowing self-discipline in a very intense and concentrated fashion, they'll be able to transplant that self-discipline into other spheres of their lives and hold off and hold back other areas of delinquent or criminal behavior. So the generating of self-discipline is contagious, and the corrosion or the erosion of self-discipline is also contagious. You constantly feel this nervous jittering and nervous need. And probably the third area, I would say, is not just distraction, thinking shallow as opposed to thinking deeply. Number two is the erosion of self-discipline. Number three is that there's a tendency to not be mindful of people. To be in a room, and I heard a story a friend of mine told me about a board meeting that took place in a very important corporation. The name doesn't make a difference, just a parable. And everyone had gathered for the meeting, and there was some young Turk who was there, and he was Facebooking and emailing and WhatsApping during the meeting. And basically the older executive ranked him out in public, probably with a lot of curses. Who do you think you are? Don't you think I have an important life? Don't you think I have thousands of emails and hundreds of WhatsApp to send? But right now, I'm here for you. Right now, I put my phone aside. I'm paying attention to this meeting, and I took the time out of my schedule. How dare you come to this meeting and all of a sudden feel that your WhatsApps and your Facebooks are so important that you have to spend half of your time and attention distracted from me? Then he's totally right. And it's very rude to people. It's very hurtful to people. And I would say that if you really want to, even if you haven't already, you should take a rule for yourself. You should never, ever, ever be WhatsApping or Facebooking extensively in a class. That's just rude and disrespectful to your teacher. That teacher took the time to come to prepare the lesson, to invest in you. And rudeness is also very, very contagious. And if you start to be rude to people, it's harder to show respect and to be sensitive to people. And I tell the boys in my shiv, you have this text. I understand you've got live people to be in contact with. I'm not trying to address that part of it. Just take your phone and go out, send them a text and come back. I'm not going to question you. I'm not going to, you're mature adults. But to sit in front of me and WhatsApp all the time, and when I'm sometimes sitting in on a shiur, let's say a visiting teacher is coming and I'm sitting where you are, I'll go over and say, I'm on call. I need to, they're coming and waiting. I have to arrange another shiur. Please excuse me. You say, what's happening? Don't think I'm just attending to my duties in a way that allows them to be in the shiur. At the very least, you should go over to the teacher and say that. My wife's expecting in a minute, or my mother's in the hospital, or I need to be online, so please don't be insulted. But and in any context. But I think it creates a certain lack of mindfulness and lack of attention to people. And to me, that's really a core trait, to be able to respect people and give them the time of day. And I feel bad sometimes. I'm caught. You could probably say that person has enough. Sometimes I'm caught because I'm just so busy at my workspace in yeshiva, and I've got so many things that are necessary, but I still want to give people time. Sometimes I'll say, I can talk to you, but I can't look at you, and I'll just give you an answer. But I just want to apologize. Not like I'm not being mindful, but right now there are three people that need an email from me about coming to yeshiva in 5 minutes, or about making a Shabbos that we think the deadline for. But it's really important to be able to, when you're not under that pressure, and at this stage in your life you're still not under that pressure, to really be able to hone in on people and give them your eyes and your attention. So I would say that this constant movement has to be constant movement has to be dealt with on those three levels. I wonder to myself, because I'm very excited about smartwatches when they're coming out, they probably start to emerge this year, next year. I wonder how that's going to affect it. It could go either way. On the one hand, because it doesn't really lend itself to reading a lot, so the distraction probably would be much less. Namely, if I let's say check WhatsApp, then all of a sudden I see a Facebook post, and I go to check out who liked me and tagged me, then all of a sudden I see an article. If I already spent 10 minutes, then suddenly it could have taken 5 seconds. That journey is less likely to happen on a watch. On the other hand, the ease of wearables is going to make that constant tick and that lack of focus more heightened. So if you can find that sweet spot between being able to stay on top of the things you need to stay on top of without getting lost and distracted into further labyrinths and mazes, but not to look at it too often, there'd be an app, let's say, that would only allow you to check your watch once every 20 or 30 minutes or something rather than more frequently, that's probably the sweet spot. Everything about technology is the sweet spot of finding the space where you're maximizing potential, but you're not getting lost in distraction and abuse. Which then brings us to the final frontier, which is social media and Facebook. Again, as you can know, these are all incremental exacerbations of each other. There's an entertainment culture, which the internet exacerbated, then mobile computing, magnified internet use. Social media is basically, it's a lot of the same DNA, but slight changes, more intense challenges, and new perils that hadn't been. Internet wasn't distracting in the sense of creating an ability to focus. It was a time waster, but you don't get the, I'm in class, I have to run to my desktop back home and check me. It didn't create that lack of attention span. So everything is just incremental to the previous. What I think is happening with Facebook and social media is as follows. Again, it creates greater access to information, imagery, ideas that you shouldn't be exposed to. So it just takes everything we've spoken about and creates greater incremental challenge. I think it challenges notions of friendship because it creates, even the word friend, even the fact that Facebook took that word and retrofitted or refitted it to something completely different. In our minds, in our synapses, in our neurons, we still, when we say friend, almost as a Facebook associations pop up and then do we take the time to invest in real friends? Or do we treat our friends, it's really a double-edged sword, do we create friendships that are artificial, and then do we artificialize the friendships we have already? There's almost an unspoken contest on Facebook to have who has more friends, right? He'll take the medal. So do we recreate those social patterns when we're not on Facebook? And when we walk, let's say, into a bar mitzvah or a wedding, are we being casual and short-changing people just because we want to say as many people as possible? Because that's the Facebook ethic of trying to reach as many people as possible rather than spending quality time with as many people as you can. Not, okay, I have to make sure I meet all my friends tonight. The same, I have to make sure that I like all my friends' posts. So I think, and this is all against social media because it's so new. I don't think anyone is fully, sociologists probably are studying these things, but I don't think anyone's fully realized what some of the dangers are. I think that there are two other areas. It's right at the boundary between developmental concerns and religious concerns. Number one is Gaiva, number two is Litzanus. Now, you may not know what I'm referring to. What's Gaiva think about Facebook and what's Litzanus about Facebook? So I'll start with Litzanus and then I'll get to Gaiva, because Litzanus is the harsher one, but Gaiva is the more subtle, but probably in most cases, it's the Gaiva that we fall into. Litzanus doesn't just mean you tell a joke. Litzanus means undercutting, subversive, people are always looking to find fault and to be dismissive and to... See, part of what social media does is it liberates people from classic outlets of news, because everyone can publish their own news and you're not beholden to news outlets, and we found, which is now we're realizing the flip end, the fake news that's proliferating. But there's a very, very distinct anti-establishment culture on the internet in general and on social media in particular. And we know better than the establishment, and Trump keyed in on this. Trump really clued in on this and tapped into this anti-establishment fervor. The establishment is all liars and fakes and paying Hillary and all of her deceitful emails and they're all to get you and it's a rigged election. And basically he fed the fears and the suspicions that are very lame, but that the internet and the social media in particular, because it's empowered. And once you're empowered, you feel liberated from being subjected to the news that the establishment wants me to see. And how that translates beyond just media and news exchange, there's a lot of negativity on social media. You're always looking to attack, and the dosage and the percentage of statements that are undercutting and subversive and finding the flaw and finding the scandal and making fun of the person and showing the fail and showing the... If you just, even if in your own world, and your world isn't probably, your own little echo chamber isn't probably even representative of what's out there because it's your friends who tend to be from Jews, but there's a high amount of poking fun, negative, cynical, dismissive, sometimes in ways that appear to be constructive. We're going to find a scandal, but you're creating a world of a lot of negativity and a lot of, and it starts to eat away at the way you view the world as a good place, and people generally good and well-intending. And what I was shocked about in the American election, I was shocked about a lot of things, but just the lack of sophistication, as if the Trump's advocates, anyone who voted for Hillary was an obscene liberal or just was obsessed. Anyone who voted for Trump was a raven. And especially for the Jews in America, were caught in between, because many of them were offended by Trump's moral degeneracy, but very attracted to his politics in general in Israel. Okay, so you can have that world. That's a hard decision, but and because everyone's just so polar about it, castigating and chastising. And I think it's being fed by these two factors. Number one, there's clearly an echo chamber, and your friend people like you, so you just hear yourself again and again and again, and you don't understand there's another side. It's very dangerous, it creates opinionated people. And number two, because a lot of the statements in that echo chamber is not, oh, let's all celebrate our opponents' virtues and their perspectives. A lot of that echoing is very, very degrading and assaulting, and it's toxic, it's noxious. And it's true in general, and I get very upset when I see it happening, when I see telling them. You used to have, in the earlier days, a distinct chauvinist tendency where Dafka women were being made fun of, you know, let's exchange the latest YouTube of the seminary girls and how silly they are. Just very ugly, just very not befitting of a bentar. Just if you're a noble person, you speak proper. You won't speak like that in yeshiva. You won't go over to people and say negative things. Oh, I heard you gave the CM yesterday. Oh, you learned Megillah. That's only 31 blah. I learned Sukkah. That's 37. And you won't talk like that. You're very respectful. You're very supportive. Somehow the anonymity of the internet creates a puritanical zeal and a moral outrage and a cockiness and a dismissive tone.
because we hide behind text and words. And like I said, everything that happens in the cybersphere is going to slowly bleed into you as a person, because you're being formed by those aspects. So I would say that's the first danger. Just if you post, it should be positive posts. It should be negative. It shouldn't be angry. It shouldn't be dismissive. Think very, 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 very carefully. I mean, if there's a child molester who moved next door to you, maybe I'll post on Facebook, beware, he's a registered child molester, watch your children. But other than that, all of a sudden to spread people's dirty laundry and point out their flaws, and it's really Lashon Hara, Motzi Shem Ra, Leitzanos. It's just really very, very ugly space of human identity that gets magnified by the anonymity and the anti-establishment nature of the internet, of social media, not the internet. The second issue, and this is probably what most people fall into, there's a certain self-promotion that the social media fuels. When you post and all of a sudden someone likes your post, you know, how many people like my post? How many people know that I'm alive and care about me? And why should it matter? But it matters to people, and more so with your posts. And here's the words I want you to really focus on. I'm very, very careful. Every post that I place, and I think about this very carefully. Again, my posts are not that heterogeneous. Most of my posts are sheer or so, but that's because I'm very careful. I'll tell you some of the posts I don't put up and why I've thought about them. My posts shouldn't be promoting, they should be connecting. Namely, connecting means there are parts of my life that people that I know, in this case because I'm a Rebbe, students of mine, may be interested in experiencing through me. So the primary one is Torah. If I'm giving a shiur, they can't attend. They may want to connect to that shiur. But it's also my experiences. So if, let's say, I went to Levaya yesterday, and I was very involved in Levaya, and for us, you were all there, or at least you had the opportunity to be there, but someone in Seattle, who had very little kesher to Levaya, but it's connected to me. So when I post a picture of Levaya, I'm connecting them to something larger than myself. They'd be interested in, that's of value. So I'm not promoting myself, the fact that I went to the Levaya. I happen to be the invisible bridge to an experience that they can't access. So it's Torah, it's Eretz Yisrael. I was very, very involved in social media two and a half summers ago, Israeli summers, during the kidnapping experiences. And I was involved because my children went to Mekor Chaim, and I'm in Gush Etzion. So I was posting daily, and people felt that part of that experience was enhanced, as hard as it is to say enhanced, but people felt more engaged because of social media. It wasn't just a kidnapping that took place on the West Bank, people really lived through those 28 days in a very visceral way because they had the signs and the sights and the clips and the videos of the entire package, the families and the rallies and the singing and the events and the search and the serious nefesh and the dignity of the parents. And I think that was social media at its best, to be quite honest. Social media used for a connecting purpose. The worst case of promotion would be, look at the hamburger I'm eating in Mivala. Now look at the steak I just ordered in Mitsuyan or something. Yeah. What are you connecting people to? The fact that you're eating a pound of meat? You're promoting your experiences, and there's nothing there that should interest people. Now there are some things that lie right along that seam, and I try to be machmir when necessary. So I'll never post. I don't have any family imprint on the internet. You wouldn't know that I have a family. You know I have a family. I'm very dedicated to my family. But I just don't feel that I should necessarily flash pictures. Now, some people feel they should. I think it's right at the scene, because why not? I mean, there are people that you know that can't share the simcha, and they're very excited to know you got engaged, and very excited to know. What I do is I just post a text on my Facebook page, mazel tov to my daughter or her wedding to whatever. So I won't post a picture. It's also partially because she's an adult, and I find it exploitative for me to take her picture and use it, you know, on my post. If she would have posted, I would have liked it because I'm her father in that case. And a lot of people put simchas, and I'm not opposed to it whatsoever. It could be because I'm a Rebbe, and I don't want my kids to feel like I'm treating them as Rebbe's children. They're just my children, so my Facebook imprint is more of an educator than a Rebbe, so therefore under that gate, I don't want them to feel like they've been Rebbe-sized or taken into a different orbit or space. So I think family events of meaning is connecting. Oh, you made a bar mitzvah, so I don't get a chance to play mazel tov, and I wish you mazel tov online. I mean, in some crazy world. Every time I see someone making a Mazel Tov, I make a list of myself because I want to call them, and then the list gets too long, and I rip it up, and I start again. But I'm going to start just writing. I hate writing Mazel Tov as a reply because I really want to speak to them in person, but it just gets out of hand. A family trip. Again, it's probably a little bit closer to promotion, but it's still well within the range because family trips are healthy and they're meaningful to people and they're meaningful to other people that your family's bonding and so you need to. But it reaches a point where there's just nothing that you're connecting people to. So imagine going to a football match. Why would you post it? What's the purpose? And if you could use that as your yardstick, that's probably, or as your benchmark, that's probably a good benchmark. What am I connecting people to with this post? If you can come up with some reasonable, meaningful subject or object that you're connecting them to, then post it. A sunset in Christian, a beautiful sunset on the beach, a family vacation, a simcha, someone being honored. These are experiences that I go through, you go through. My friends, well, some of them may be interested in looking at it through me. Obviously, news items as well. If there's a news item that you feel is worthy for people to share. In the absence of that, you're just promoting yourself. You just want people to know about you. And it's just not sneers. And that's really at the heart of lack of sneers is wanting people to see you and take note of you. And unfortunately, that's really the world we live in. Everyone's trying to vie for our attention and dress for our attention and speak for our attention and act outrageously for our attention. That's really the core of sneers. The real goal of sneers is I want you to know you exist. You should be happy about that because you don't really care about public opinion, public interest. You just care about things that are important. If anything, public interest can pollute or can distract you from really honing in on what your values are because you're playing with the public rather than building values that are important to you. So I would say that's, to me, that's probably the cutting edge of concerns for me on social media. And if you can be a connector, you're using social media properly. If you see yourself transforming from a connector to a promoter, then I think you're starting to abuse your space as a bent tower. I think even developmental, I don't think being self-promotional is a value at any level, even not for religious people. Okay, so those are some of the thoughts on the three sectors, on the culture of technology, as I spoke about earlier. Obviously, these are all emergent experiences, and no one has solutions or answers to them. It's important just, as I said before, not to be all in. Not to be so excited. I don't know many rabbis in the world that use technology more than I'm not sure there are, but I'd probably be in the top whatever. In BuzzFeed's top. So I really use it. I've been using it for many, many years, and I was involved in technology way, way, way before there was an internet. I built an intranet for 80,000 people. So I really understand the value of technology in Baruch Hashem. I've used it to spread Torah. I've made my fair share of mistakes. So I'm not here to demonize technology. If anything, I'm more in than most people here in this room, and I could probably explain it and use it. But just be conscious that, as with everything, it carries a price tag, and the greatest dangers are not when we face true evil and criminals, but when we face experiences which are positive by and large and ennobling, but we don't realize the latent dangers, the latent detriments, and we just immerse ourselves so deeply that we lose our guard and we let down our guard. Okay. You don't want to ask any questions? Michelle?
You spoke about movies and entertainment, like immersing oneself in that world of entertainment, trying to escape from our world. How's that different to reading novels?
Because I think it depends which novels. If you're reading fantasy novels, probably not much different. I haven't read fantasy novels, I can't talk about Harry Potter, but you read fantasy and escape novels. Again, there's one difference because in most cases, the content of the novels won't be as dangerous as sometimes movies can be. So it's gratuitous sex. But in theory, you could have gratuitous sexual depiction in a novel as well. Again, it's not imagery, it's ideas. So it's a little bit more abstract. But if you're asking me about Shakespeare and Thomas Hardy, so generally these are people who wrote trying to give a meaning of life and human conditions. So they can be both relaxing as well as meaning and content providing at the same time. But the margins or the differentials between escapist novels and escapist movies are much smaller than the differentials between, let's say, real content. Or the content, it could be well-written editorials, and a big film, people sometimes apply for yeshiva and they ask me what they can do to prepare for yeshiva. I'll say just read some editorials in a newspaper. Sometimes their thinking process in high school is so simplified and so stigmatized and stereotypical, just to read ideas, read powerful ideas written well. I mean, nothing like cogent articulation of meaningful ideas. The combination of form and substance is a very powerful combination. But if you want to read Harry Potter, it's probably cleaner than most movies to watch. But let's say you stack up Harry Potter through a Disney movie, there's no difference.
The intellectual gain that you get from a book can also be the same that you get from a movie?
I don't think so. It's very complicated. Well, first of all, even if the content level is equally sophisticated, just the engagement demands of reading, we have to actually process information rather than the passivity of movie watching, is an important differential. Second of all, just the medium of a movie doesn't allow the level of subtlety and complexity. It's very hard. In general, you could fit more meaning into 3 pages of a well-written novel than into a 2-hour movie. You're deluding yourself if you think otherwise. It's just the way the medium is shaped. And that's why it's so popular. These things aren't incidental. The movies aren't popular because fate, unfortunately, because they speak to people's passivity, they speak to people's shallow, they speak to people's. When I work out, I watch movies or I watch television. I don't listen to audio novels because I don't have the mental energy to both exercise, and whatever mental energy takes to exercise as well as engage in a book. So sometimes it's insecure, but sometimes it's hard for me. So I'll potentially watch a movie or a documentary because I can't allocate as much mental energy to the medium, but I need the distractions that I don't get lost in the work. So you understand what a movie's purpose is, you're watching for that reason. Okay, guys. Welcome back, guys. When does the program end?